The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show. Hey, do you like to eat nuts? Like super nummy hazelnuts and almonds and filberts and macadamia nuts and Brazil nut? Right? You like cracking them open and digging out the choicest morsels of delectable nut meats? Because I really don't. Yep, no reason, just not a big nut fan. Never have been. Anyway, here's Mr. Totally Nutty McNutsu himself, Eric Metaxas.
Hey there, folks. This is the Eric Metaxas Show, and the best part about this show is the guests. I am thrilled to have back in our studio Heather McDonald. The new book is The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. Heather McDonald, welcome back.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. It was too short a time, and we have so much more still to talk about.
I was going
to
say, you're just fun to talk to, and that's my ultimate arbiter. If it's fun, I think it's probably valuable. Now, we can start with Peggy Noonan, whom we both know, says, I read every word Heather McDonald writes and always have. She is brilliant, has tons of guts, and an inspiration. That sums it up for me. And I know my audience is thrilled to get to know you, those who don't already know you. But we're living in weird times, aren't we? We were just talking about that before we went on the air here. Even Peggy Noonan wrote an article, you know, one of her lapidary articles that she writes every week in the Wall Street Journal, effectively saying that that Schiff and company had made the case for impeachment. And I thought, wow, we're living in weird times when even Peggy would say that, or Jonah Goldberg has said that. So I don't know. We didn't need to start there, but I just thought we're just living in strange times.
Well, you know, Trump is a divisive character, although, frankly, he's no more divisive. No, he's no more divisive than our culture. And again, I would say he's a reaction to something that has been brewing on the left for decades now, which is the concerted effort to delegitimate America through the poisonous medium of identity politics. I am so sick of hearing this week about the fact that it is somehow a sign of white supremacy that there are now just two black people in the Democratic primary field. You know what? I crunched the numbers, Eric. That's 2 out of 15. That's 13% of the Democratic candidates now are black. That's exactly proportional to the black population in the nation at large. And yet we are told that the only thing that matters is the color of a candidate's skin, and that somehow the Democratic voters, and black voters in particular, in supporting Joe Biden, are engaged in a massive assault on minorities, which is ridiculous.
Well, it's actually when those on the left, meaning specifically CNN and MSNBC, made the case last week that black voters were somehow kowtowing to the electability of whites only in saying that they preferred Biden or Buttigieg to Kamala Harris or something. I thought that is the most absolutely it's a couple of things, but it is really, if anything, is a kind of a racist view of black voters,
right?
That they don't have the ability to think for themselves and that they are themselves kowtowing to some kind of white expectation. I thought that's, if anything is racist and looking down on a group, that sums it up.
Right. Well, the media has two strategies. One, they ignore the fact that it is the black voters that are giving Biden his main body of support at this point. Usually the narrative doesn't mention that, so we're left with the impression that somehow it's whites who are destroying the rainbow diversity of the Democratic primary But then every so often they're just forced to concede the facts. So it's quite remarkable. And, you know, the idea that this is a white supremacist country is so preposterous. When let's just talk about conservatives who really are what they're talking about. So the Democratic media has to, like, really twist itself into knots because they're talking about Democrats here, and yet what they really want to do is put the knife into the backs of conservatives. Republicans have had one love affair after another with black politicians, whether it's Colin Powell, Alan Keyes, Alan West, Ben Carson. What matters to Americans is ideology and character and behavior. Race plays nothing into that equation. Americans are so willing to vote for whoever, regardless of skin color, if they embody values that the voters care about.
I was just going to say the names, Condoleezza Rice. You could go on and on and on. Thomas Sowell. We're living in such bizarre times. You said, I mean, you focus, obviously, in your book, The Diversity Delusion, but in much of your career in latter years, you have focused on this issue of, you know, the fracturing of everything into these groups, race and gender pandering you talk about. And you said, and I think you're right, that the election of Trump was a reaction, that people had finally said, this is madness. We need someone who, whether in a sophisticated or ham-fisted way, can begin to deal with this.
Absolutely. I think people understood that national sovereignty was at stake. You know, have Rich Lowry coming on, or will be on your show this week, that really the left is now trying to destroy the capacity of a people to say, we are going to decide what our national identity is. That's not allowed anymore. And Trump has had some really fine moments. For me, the finest moment in the Republican primary debates was when he said, I don't have time to be politically correct. And, you know, you had the press and Fox News beating up on him for beating up on Megyn Kelly. I refuse to take this position that just because I'm a female, I should be exempt from criticism. But that's the bizarre sort of reinvention of Victorian values that we see going on in the left, that Trump gets a semi-free pass for having his little snide nicknames and digs at males. But as soon as he gives equal treatment, I thought we're supposed to be for equal treatment, to females, and has an epithet for a female, then all of a sudden it becomes about gender. Just as the way race is a shield, if Trump criticizes a black politician like a member or a person of color like a member of the squad and says, you are not grateful for this country, rather than that being a criticism on the merits, which is what it is, it becomes about race. And so the rule is in our society today, as a female, I should be exempt from criticism. If I don't get promoted, it's not because I may not be good enough. It's because I'm being discriminated against on the basis of sex. And it goes for blacks and Hispanics as well. And Trump was a sort of a lifeline against the further destruction of meritocratic standards.
It's extraordinary because you really get this false choice between a patronizing attitude. I mean, the left is patronizing toward women and toward minorities in a way that we could rightly call sexist and racist. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinary thing.
Right.
And they're not consistent. I mean, let's face it. When Trump called, you know, Rosie O'Donnell fat and ugly and that kind of thing, I, as a man, said that's out of bounds. But the reason I say that's out of bounds is because I actually do think that no one should speak about a woman that way. So it's got nothing to do with Trump or his politics or anything like that. I am not someone who likes Rosie O'Donnell.
For chivalry.
Yeah,
I totally agree with you, Eric. But of course, we cannot espouse those values without being accused of sexism,
right,
even as the left is wrapping females in this mantle of virtue that in many cases does not is not deserved, as we see in the campus rape fanaticism, when you've got the refusal to what's called slut shaming, which is in fact just noticing the fact that females who drink themselves blotto, I mean, it is the most disgusting behavior, are like literally drinking themselves unconscious. If we say that that deliberate voluntary activity may have some effect on your later involvement in sex.
Can you imagine? We're going to be right back, folks. The good news, we're talking to Heather McDonald. Don't go away.
This is Wings, I think. Beatles, I can tell you.
Somebody told me that some member of Queen was an astrophysicist or something.
Folks, I'm talking to Heather McDonald. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. We're talking about everything, and that's always fun. The book, however, is The Diversity Delusion, How Race and Gender Pandering Corrupt the University and Undermine Our Culture. Heather, you were just making a big point before we made to the break about so-called slut shaming. And I mean, just this abdication of integrity. In other words, we don't, and I don't mean moral integrity. I just mean defining our terms. How ought we to behave? When is it okay to criticize that behavior? If I had a daughter, I do have a daughter. If I have a daughter or a niece or anyone in my life who is dressing inappropriately,
yes,
in a way that cheapens her as a woman and a human being, and getting drunk almost to the point of passing out, and then you criticize that, and somebody says, "Well, how dare you criticize a woman for anything?" You think, "Well, what is she, a little child that belongs to someone else, and I don't have the right to criticize public behavior?"
It's absolutely remarkable. I think part of it is that we are unwilling to have any kind of stigma. Now, I have to immediately qualify that. Let me put an asterisk. But things that were once dealt with social norms that had to have stigma attached, there had to be consequences. There are certain norms that are good for society. Do not have children out of wedlock. Do not act like a slut. You know, respect yourself. Control your impulses.
Right.
If you break those, it's for the good of society to have some kind of penalty attached. Now, in the individual case, and I would say the biggest antisocial behavior that our society is dealing with now is having children out of wedlock. This is a social catastrophe of just cataclysmic proportions. It's very difficult to understand all of the ramifications for what it means for the marriage norm to break down. But it used to be that that marriage norm was backed up with stigma directed overwhelmingly towards the female, which one could say is unfair, but that's life. She also has the greatest negative consequences for having children out of wedlock. So we got rid of all that. 19th century literature is filled with examples that are heartbreaking. It seems, oh, that's so unfair, this poor woman taken advantage by some aristocratic rake, and now she's the one cast out of the village. Nevertheless, those individual sacrifices were necessary in order to preserve the norm. Now we say we can't have stigma, except, of course, if you violate the politically correct stigmas and say, you know, something that is viewed as insufficiently sensitive towards the favored victim groups, then you're banished from the public internet sphere. They're going to try to end your career completely. So it's sort of a movement of stigma. But I think we're losing our willingness to say that certain behaviors are bad both for the individual and bad for society.
And that's why Trump is such a conundrum, because, you know, on the one hand, he often says things that I don't think he should put it that way or put it this way. I don't think he should say the full words for BS or for kicking somebody's A instead
right.
of butt
yeah.
or whatever, like, because there are kids at the rallies and da 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 da. And yet his unwillingness to bow to politically correct standards is so outrageously refreshing. Mm-hmm. In fact, we don't deserve it as a culture. So this is a gift to me from God, that he is so refreshing in his unwillingness to worry about the people who worry about those things, that it's just, as I said earlier, it's a funny moment in the culture. And I think most Americans, as you were saying earlier, they're reacting to that aspect of him and to his humor toward the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to be a little further hard on Trump because, unfortunately, he is not consistently where he should be in pushing back against some of these elite narratives. And I'm going to single out one thing in particular, Eric. I think he has been very destructive in his opportunistic embrace of the left's narrative about policing and the criminal justice system. He signed this First Step Act, which decreased sentences for federal prisoners, which I actually don't object to. I think sentencing is always arbitrary. So it's not as if there's some platonic ideal for what a sentence should be for dealing meth. It's arbitrary. And if they'd been 2 years shorter to begin with, nobody really would have noticed. So I'm okay with monkeying with sentencing. But I object to what Trump has done in promoting his role in signing this law is to say that he is correcting the racism of the 1994 criminal reform bill that Clinton passed and Joe Biden advocated that increased funding for police, that did increase sentence lengths for repeat offenders, and made it possible for the federal government to get involved in what was then an extraordinarily important fight on crime. And Trump has been playing the race card there. And I think that's extremely unfortunate because this is a narrative that makes it harder and harder for the police to maintain public order in high crime communities.
You've been a big advocate of law enforcement. Let's talk a little bit about that because I've seen you on Fox talk about that a number of times. We're living in, again, very strange times. The idea that a couple of hippies crying, police brutality becomes a huge part of our national narrative that we have to talk about almost nightly on the news. So what do you say to that?
Well, it's a longstanding reality that reached its head with the Black Lives Matter movement. President Obama invited Black Lives Matter activists to the White House. We don't have that anymore, which is, as you say, a big blessing. On the other hand, that hatred for law enforcement, that hatred for the criminal justice system is continuing now at the local prosecutorial level. And it all results from the fact, I think, the big driver of much of our social discourse today is this very pernicious concept of disparate impact, that any neutral standard, whether it's an academic standard for, promotion or tenure, a standard in a corporation for what are the skills you need to get ahead, or a law enforcement standard that says you shall not jump turnstiles in the subway, you shall not urinate in public, you shall not commit robbery. If that standard has a disparate impact on minorities, we are supposed to believe that however colorblind it is somehow racist.
And well, it's patronizing. Again, it's like saying, listen, those poor people aren't incapable of holding to our white elite standards, and we need to give them a pass. And the moment you do that, you leave the colorblind society that Martin Luther King Jr. was hoping we could achieve. I mean, there's tremendous irony and hypocrisy in it.
Right. And I cannot overstate how sweeping this attack on meritocratic standards are. It's across our culture, whether it's in media, in business, in the science fields, and in law enforcement. We are rapidly, rapidly undercutting meritocratic standards in order to promote and protect people on the basis of these utterly trivial, uninteresting categories of race and gender. And in the policing matter, I mean, that's what's going on. Unfortunately, there is an exponential difference in crime rates between blacks and whites. And the victimization is also exponentially different. Blacks die of homicide at six times the rate of whites and Hispanics combined. That's the civil rights problem that should concern the activists.
That's the center of the problem in Chicago, isn't it?
Right. But who's killing them? It's not the police. It's not white supremacists. It's other blacks, because the black homicide rate is about 11 times that of whites. The face of violent street crime today is black and Hispanic, and nobody wants to talk about that. Instead, we're all just talking about the police, which is ridiculous.
What do you think of the fact that Bloomberg recently disavowed the stop and frisk policy that worked so well for him?
He has removed the only reason to vote for him, that, and he did back welfare reform while he was mayor as well. But he's shown the same cowardice that every other member, Joe Biden included, who has tried to repudiate his more centrist positions. And Bloomberg is simply wrong. He was right. His former position was right. But it shows how far the left has taken over the Democratic Party today.
Well, it is very dramatic, and it's why I think they are in big trouble in the 2020 elections, because they don't have the moral courage to stand up for what's right when they have been right. They don't have the moral courage to stand against the AOCs and the Maoists and the Stalinists among them. And I find that very telling. And Trump's moral courage, to me, it's why he won and why he will win again.
Well, maybe so. I don't know about moral courage. I think he's simply sort of indifferent to criticism. I'm not sure he understands really what he's doing. He may. At some level, I do think he has some basic instincts about America. I think he's patriotic. I also want to say, let me just say, he is not a sexist and he is not a racist. That is so clear. Again, I totally agree with you that men should treat women with respect, but he's not a misogynist. Give me a break.
Well, I agree. We're going to be right back, fortunately, with more Heather McDonald. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Don't go away.
It's the best time of the year.
Hey, folks, that is Burl Ives, if you're scoring at home. I am the host, Eric Metaxas, and my guest is Heather McDonald. Heather, so much to talk about. I want to ask you, we just were talking about Trump's, I called it moral courage. When I think of moral courage in Trump, I think of things like his standing up for Kavanaugh all the way to the bitter end, when I'm convinced any other GOP president would not have done that, would have caved to the vicious, super angry, I have said demonic, screeching left. At the end of that whole bizarre experience, I thought, this is madness. And thank goodness Daddy was home and he could say, no, Kavanaugh's a good guy and I'm going to stick for him. I thought that took moral courage.
Okay, you're right. Nevertheless, but I think he's also simply stubborn, and that can be a good thing, too.
Right.
If he makes the right decision, he should stick by it.
Right.
I would just say, I've recently had some conversations with people, business owners, who say he was not the most moral businessman. And I've heard the same thing.
And
he makes promises. He pledges money for reviving Carnegie Hall, pledged $100,000.
Yeah.
And then reneged on his promise, said, well, you should pay me $100,000 because you used my name. This was to Stephen Brill. So, he does not always live by his promises.
Yeah, no, I didn't mean moral generally. When I say moral courage, I'm saying it's kind of courage. It's a certain kind of backbone. I also think that when he moved the embassy to Jerusalem, there's something there that we haven't seen in the GOP in a while.
I agree.
And I have to say that, that's laudable. But you're quite right about these other things. You wrote an article very recently called Why Are College Students So Afraid of Me? It appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Tell us about that. Why are college students so afraid of you?
Because I tell them they're not oppressed, and there's nothing that drives a college student more insanely mad and vulnerable and trembling than being told you are, in fact, privileged. You are the most privileged individual in human history by virtue of your unfettered access to knowledge. The students at this point have a profound emotional stake in this victim identity that says that to be on a college campus of all places is to be surrounded by an existential threat to their identities based on race and gender.
Let me ask you, you were at Yale a couple of years before me. Was this atmosphere at Yale when you were there?
Not at all.
Okay. It was when I was there.
Yes.
I was there in the early 80s, and I, coming from a working class European immigrant background, was just stunned suddenly to bump into things of which I had never dreamt or heard in my life. And I got caught up in it. I say this as a repentant mm-hmm. sinner. The idea sure. that I had so little convictions and courage that I drifted along with this. But I remember a couple of key moments. We did a vote for, do we divest from South Africa? Mm-hmm. And I had a friend who's a Democrat who nonetheless said economically, this is the wrong move. And he dared to vote that we do not divest our class funds. And, you know, some of the Red Guards who were manning the polling on this issue said, hey, your buddy Chris voted the wrong way, whatever. And that was the first moment, like the penny dropped for me. And I thought, where am I?
Uh-huh.
This is like being in the Mao's Cultural Revolution. If you don't vote the right way, you're going to be vilified. And I bought into a lot of this, and that anger and that identity as a victim.
Right.
It was very strong already in the early 80s. So that's I'm just curious when it started. So it wasn't at Yale in the late 70s, but it was there in the early 80s.
No. And as we talked about last time, what was there was this crazy literary theory known as deconstruction and post-structuralism. And that provided sort of the rhetoric, the mannered rhetoric, the separation from reality that would be absorbed by multiculturalism, by all
right.
the different gender-based studies, you know. Black studies existed long before deconstruction, but it just got worse and worse. And I would also say something that has like deeper roots but wasn't as prominent in the 70s was simply the glorification of youth culture and the fact that adolescents should be heard. My view is no, they should be seen maybe if they will take the piercings out, you know, and the tattoos off. But generally, they don't know anything. Why should we treat them as these clarion truth tellers?
I'll tell you why. It's an entire Enlightenment romantic philosophy that finally took hold in American mainstream culture in the 60s. We know this. Never trust anybody over 30. It is sheer lunacy.
Mm-hmm.
Millennia of history and cultures have told us that it's sheer lunacy. But in 1968, the administrators at Columbia did not have the moral authority to kick out these communist hothead kids
right.
from their offices. And so, yeah, we're kind of living with that.
Yeah, academics, the faculty has let us down. They not only will not push back against the insane politics. Now, of course, most of them subscribe to those politics. But they also have let us down just when it comes to the, in one sense, much more important issue of passing on our inheritance. They do not have the courage to say, we know something about history. We know something about the grand scope of Western civilization that you don't, and we know the books that you should be reading. And if you get out of here without reading those books, we have failed in our duty. Now, when I go around to talk on college campuses, Eric, I ask students what they're majoring in and what their favorite courses are. The answers are so profoundly depressing.
No, but the key is parents are spending money you might as well send your kid to indoctrinate them against you and everything you believe in and pay a lot of money for it. We're going to be right back talking to Heather McDonald. The book is The Diversity Delusion. To interrupt Michael Jackson, but I've got a show to do. I'm talking to Heather McDonald. Heather, we were just talking about several different things. You were just talking about the situation in colleges right now, and the bigger picture, because college is where it manifests itself. But this idea that came into the culture in the 60s that the youth are innocent and they have something to tell us and that the old people don't know anything, that is a utopianist strain. It goes back to the French Revolution. I mean, you see this over and over and over. It's fundamentally wrong, but it has taken hold so dramatically that we're living for 50 years now with the results of it.
Well, and I actually date it to the 50s, which was, it's a function, sadly, of the triumph of American capitalism, that we had so much prosperity that youth in the 50s had spending power that was simply delegated to them by their parents. It's not as if they were out there working and earning money in the main. I mean, obviously, working class kids were, but generally, you know, they had their parents' credit cards. And so you had corporations, I don't blame them, you know, they didn't see what was coming, and they're amoral, spotting a new market and creating a youth culture because it's something you can purchase and market and it becomes a commodity. So that predated the rise of the flower children and flower power and whatnot.
You're right.
And now, you know, that we have huge aspects of the economy are simply revolving around the tastes of adolescents, and they have lousy taste.
Yeah, and they're dumb. I hate to say
they
that,
are dumb.
It's true. No, but it's just, isn't it funny? Because when I was 15 or 14 or 13, and my father would say to me that I know more than you do, because he had been through a war, and because my mother had escaped communism, and because my parents worked their tails off to put food on the table, I respected that, even though I might have disagreed with it. And I wouldn't have dared said, I know more than you do. I just wasn't hanging around anybody who had those ridiculous ideas. But the idea that it's kind of taken hold in the culture and that the media has pushed it dramatically, I would argue that that's the downside of the free market, in the sense that if you do not have virtue, democracy without virtue, capitalism without virtue. The virtue is what makes it work. And that when you're really just going after the almighty buck, you become the amoral corporation and you harm the whole culture.
Yeah. And we saw that with the cave-ins on the bathroom bills. And, you know, the corporations are not going to stand up for what's right if it hurts their bottom line.
But there used to be, as you said earlier, stigma attached. If a company, I mean the NBA or whoever it is, if they would do something profoundly craven and if not un-American, even anti-American, people would stop buying their products. That's really no longer the case. We're not educating the culture on how you should never give money, for example, to the NBA if they are not willing to stand with the pro-American, pro-freedom protesters in Hong Kong. My goodness, this is a huge moral issue that doesn't seem to be talked about very much.
Well, you know, we do have boycotts on the left. So those, you know, they are trying to leverage consumer power to put Tucker Carlson out of business.
But isn't that the point? On the left, we don't have it on the right.
Right.
Why not?
Right. I think there's been feeble efforts, and it may be that, I don't know, we're not as organized or what. But I would just say, like, pushing further on the anti-Confucian values with youth not having respect for the elders, parents, or professors. I mean, what's happened to professors on college campuses with students cursing at them, screaming at them, is just unbelievable. These outbreaks of rage. Asian students come from abroad to the United States, and they are utterly stunned by what they see, that there is no deference to professors.
No respect.
And instead, the classroom is just one roiling cauldron of hatreds and animosities and resentments. And they're all saying, don't call on me, don't call on me, don't call on me, because I don't want to step into this. You know, you have the feminists are beating up on the critical race theory people and stuff. It's just,
and that's only in the loopy lit classes. I want to get back to our alma mater, Yale. You referred to cursing. Christakis, the dean of one of the residential colleges, whose wife was a professor, they are not conservatives, but somehow they managed to cling to some basic common sense values, dared to express those values, one of those values being civility and respect for other points of view. And then Christakis, the dean, was famously cursed out by a little harridan. I don't know who she was. in a normal world, she would have been expelled instantly for talking to an administrator in that way. But the Yale administration has no courage. They are cowards. And I have to say, I would think twice before sending my kid to any of those elite institutions because of this.
Well, I don't know what institution is left to send to, because I can tell you that the identity victimology is everywhere. But Yale, Peter Salovey is one of the worst. And it was not just one Harridan that cursed it at Nicholas Christakis. He was surrounded by an entire mob of students who cursed at him for an hour. Not only did Yale not punish any of them, and there were things like, we're dying, and, you know, shut the F up, you are disgusting. You know, you were disgusting yesterday, you're disgusting today, you're going to be... This is somebody who is a world-renowned psychologist, sociologist, has gotten awards aplenty, and is a progressive.
And the little twits who made those comments.
Two of them got racial justice prizes.
Okay.
Two of them, upon graduation, Yale conferred their prize,
right,
for advancing race relations in the university. In fact, what they did was terrify any remaining person who believed in civility and the ability to speak the truth about, in this case, it was the fact that Yale students should be allowed to devise their Halloween costumes without oversight from Yale's diversity.
And we
police.
Should say that not only did they get those awards, but they all got Chairman Mao tattoos. and the university paid for it. Actually, what's interesting to me, what I was going to say, is let's think that these loudmouthed, immature fools are Yale students. These are not kids on the street of New York. These are Yale students. It's so hard to get into Yale. They got in. That's the kind of behavior they exhibited. We're going to be right back talking to the author of The Diversity Delusion, Heather McDonald. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Don't go away.
So hoop-dee-doo. And Dickory Dock, don't forget to hang up your sock, because just exactly at 12 o'clock, he'll be coming down the chimney down.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter, when the snow comes to cover the ground. It's time for play. It's a whipped cream day. I wait for it to hold you around. Those are marshmallow clouds being friendly in the arms of the evergreen trees. And the sun is red like a pumpkin head. It's shining so your nose won't freeze.
That is Dean Martin, and I was with his daughter, Dina Martin, recently, listening to her sing this song in person. It's so beautiful.
Aww.
And I have to say that in the Christmas special, the TBN Christmas special, I perform this with Victoria Jackson.
Yeah, one of the highlights, I must say.
She plays the role of Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
I play the role of Dean Martin. And you know what? I look way more like Dean Martin than she looks like Sinatra. I got to say,
she really didn't
make an effort.
No.
That's the problem with Victoria. But it's such a we had such a great time. We sang Christmas carols and stuff. If you didn't see the TBN Christmas special, ladies and gentlemen, I promise you, there's just something for everybody in it. If you want to find out more details, go to tbn.org for listings in your area or whatever. But it's just on. Like, I don't know, they're playing it like seven times over the holidays. Don't miss it.
Don't.
Alvin, people are still giving to CSI.
Yes.
There is still time to give to CSI.
Yep. Still time.
I want to encourage people. Christian Solidarity International is freeing slaves in the Sudan. What an amazing thing that we have the freedom to use our money and our freedom to free those who have no freedom. They're in slavery. We know that radical Muslims in Africa believe in slavery. Their worldview doesn't say this is bad. They don't believe we're all created in God's image and we're all equal. They think that if you're a Christian, you're unequal, and they have been enslaving people for a number of decades. We have to do what we can to free these people. CSI helps us to do that. And it's hard for me even to think about this sometimes.
Yeah, I know.
But I'll tell you something, what's really great is that this Christmas season, for $250 or any amount toward that, you are paying to free a human being from slavery. It's an amazing thing. And it's not just that some of these people have been enslaved for 20 years and more. But when they get out of slavery, they still have to get acclimated to life again as a free person. And sometimes the family that they are going back to didn't even know where they were for 5, 10, 20 years.
I mean, can you imagine you found out that somebody's in prison for 20 years and for $250 you could get them out. And you know that they don't belong there, that it's a wrong that's been done to them, a horrible, horrible, horrible wrong. And you say, well, it's not my problem. Folks, this is our problem. And we can all give something. The only question is what? There's some people that can give $1,000 and not feel the pinch at all. It's all tax deductible. There's some people that can give $100. There's some people that can give $40. There's some people that can give very little. But you know what? It doesn't matter what you give. The point is, give something. Please, folks, you go to our website, metaxastalk.com, and you give anything. It's between you and God. But the point is, if you were enslaved, literally enslaved, wouldn't you want those people who claim to be Christians over there in the West to lift their fingers to do something? Well, this is all teed up for you. You're not having to go over and get involved. All you have to do is either write a check or make a phone call, or you can go to our website, metaxastalk.com, and click on the banner. Everybody can give something, and I hope you'll understand that we're all on the hook for this, folks. These people are suffering. We can do something about it. We're obliged to. The reason we have our freedom and what money we have and the things that we have is so that we can help those who can't help themselves. These folks can't do anything. And if you were in their shoes, you know you'd want somebody to do something. Yeah. Do what you can. God bless you and thank you.
If you would like to contact CSI, dial 888-253-3522. That's 888-253-3522.
And have yourself a merry little Christmas. No.